Hey guys, I'm happy to announce a partnership with Reformation Heritage Books. Do you want to start reading the Puritans but just don't know where to begin? Puritan Treasures for Today from Reformation Heritage Books makes the riches of these godly writers of old accessible for the modern reader. With updated language and helpful instructions, these classic works from John Owen, Jeremiah Burroughs, and more are the perfect starting point for the curious reader. Learn more about the Puritan Treasures for Today at heritagebooks.org/puritantreasures. Use coupon code SHEPHERDS for 10% off your order. That's heritagebooks.org/puritantreasures. Coupon code SHEPHERDS. Welcome to the Shepherd's Crook Podcast. This ministry exists to provide coaching, resources, and events for pastors and church members. My name is Jared Sparks. Join me as I talk pastoral ministry, applied theology like manhood and womanhood, political theology, and cultural analysis with a little bit of hunting and fishing thrown in. I'm a husband, a father, and a pastor, and I'm here to remind you of the chief pastor and our King, Jesus. Hello and welcome to the Shepherd's Crook Podcast. Hope you guys are having a great day today. We have some cool things on the pipeline today. I want to also remind you about things that are coming here very soon. First, just be reminded of the Fruitful and Fearless Podcast. Jordan and the girls are doing a really great thing, and it's been a lot of fun to see that show continue to develop over the years. I want to check that out, ladies, if you're listening in, and make sure and subscribe if you haven't yet. Also, the Sons and Slaves Podcast. Me and the boys are having a blast going through Bob Schultz's book, Boyhood and Beyond. We're talking about raising sons into men, and so please check that out as well. And then just want to remind you of the intensive. It's coming up in May 8th through the 10th, and we have Andrew Isker coming to talk about what it means to pursue power. How do you pursue power without being kind of like a super apostle or something like that from Corinth? So we're going to look at the godly pursuit of power. We also have Will Spencer coming, and then Matt Reynolds from Barbell Logic is going to be there. We're going to be doing some deadlift competitions and all that kind of fun stuff, and everything that we normally do. So the float trips and all that is going to be a part of it, and we're getting a really cool for the swag this year. We're getting a buck knife for everybody. So fathers and sons, you'll both get a knife. Everybody that's coming will get that, and most of you will get some hats and other gear as well. So if you haven't heard about the intensive, please consider coming. Eminence, Missouri, May 8th through the 10th. Check that out. I'll put that link in the show notes. Okay, we are talking to a recurring guest now. This is his second time on here. I'm talking to Nate Endicott. Nate, how's it going, man?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
Good. We're going to talk about hunting season. You've had a pretty amazing season. Been following along on Instagram, so I'm looking forward to that. But let's go ahead and start with prayer. Father, I just thank you for this time. I thank you for a brother and a friend, and I just ask that you would continue as he's just living life and raising his family, raising the kids, and then hunting and marriage and all that's tied up into life as a man. I pray that you'd bring blessing to him and his family. God, this conversation, I wanted to honor you and just for us to have fun. Thank you for hunting stories, for just the enjoyment of being able to do something that just brings so much joy to us personally as men, but also to our families as well. And really looking forward to hearing, you know, all that's happened over the last several months with Nate. And just thank you for this time. I trust that you're going to bless this conversation. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.
Amen.
All right, brother. For those that may not have heard about you from the last episode, why don't you kind of do the introduction thing again? Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and then what it is that you do, family, all that good stuff?
Yeah. 37 years old, live in Springfield, Oregon, which is central, kind of southern Willamette Valley. So we're pretty much near the coast. Went to school in Portland, Oregon, which is closer to Washington along the Columbia Gorge. I went to Portland State University, got a degree in civil engineering. After school, moved back home. It got a job at a water utility. I've been there for 12 years. So I'm a civil engineer at a water utility and get a lot of projects done with pump stations and reservoirs, treatment plant. So that keeps me really busy. Raise a family. So I'm up to 4 kids now. We have a girl, boy. And just trying to keep up with that. And then any chance I get, I want to be in the woods. So that's kind of the brief summary.
Nice.
Yeah.
Bear fruit and multiply. Fill the earth. So do it. There we go.
More arrows than the quiver.
Hey, so you've been at the same job for 12 years, you said. So what do you got to put in, 25 years or 30 years for retirement?
Sure.
Something like that.
Yeah, it's the pension program's a 30-year. It always gets longer.
Like, right.
Yeah, every generation's working more.
Exactly. In Illinois is just awful when it comes to our budget, politics, everything. Yeah. It's just like the worst of the worst. And, you know, for all the great things that are happening at the federal level, which is exciting, this stuff that's happening in Illinois is always, you know, just kind of depressing a little bit. But my parents were both had state jobs, and my father retired at, I think, 52 years old, and received every single dime he put back into his retirement within like the first 4 years of being retired. So it's like, it's the problem of Illinois. But for those that have those gigs, man, what a good deal. And so ministry is a little bit different. I've got to find other ways to have multiple streams of income and all that kind of stuff for the long haul. But okay, so you're also a runner. I know you ran in college, and so how's running life when it comes to family and you know, getting in the woods and all that kind of stuff? You still get out there and pound some pavement every once in a while?
Every once in a while. I don't do a ton of running anymore. Seems like the hiking has been a good replacement, to be honest. So as long as I can go on a hike or two in a week and put in several hours of hiking, that it's almost better. And I've never known that to be completely transferable. So growing up, I'd pack out elk during September and then go into the fall cross country season. And no, I was still a good runner. Like, I still was running during the hunting seasons. But now later on in life, it's like, if I'm not hiking, then I'm definitely not able to run. But I was hiking a ton last spring doing shed hunting. And then there was the Keep Hammering 10K, and I hadn't run at all. And it was about 2.5 to 3 weeks out from that race. And some people were putting it in my head, like, hey, you should run that. And I was like, yeah, I haven't really been running, like, none at all the whole year from January 1 until the summer dates. It was like, it was middle of the summer. So, like, I don't know, July. I'd been putting in a lot of miles, probably 18 mile days on slopes, you know, jamming up a few thousand feet in a day, no problem. Your shed hunting is something I've been doing later on in life, and it's literally a means to stay in shape. And also, I love hiking. It's like, I don't really want to pound pavement. I'd rather put my time in the woods if I'm going to be working out, and that time away is valuable, you know, with family. So yeah. Okay. So I was doing 15 to 18 mile days, and then I went and ran three times and did that 10K and ended up winning it. You have to climb almost 1,000 feet in 3 miles, and then your second half of the race is all downhill. So from like a strategy perspective, being a runner, I was like, well, as long as I can get to the top, I can get down. And that's what happened. So I don't have to run to be able to maintain a good level of fitness, cardio, and leg strength. But the hiking, it's doing wonders for me, and it's not the impact because it's a slow, moderate pace all day. And then if you go hike straight uphill for 30 minutes straight, your heart's going to be pounding, but yet there's no impact. So I was basically doing high intensity interval workout all day. Mm. So high intensity, low all day. You can get your heart spiked by just jamming uphill, and then you side hill, side hill, side hill. And then it's just moderate, but you're stabilizing muscles, knees, ankles, hips. But back east, you guys don't have a ton of contours, but I highly recommend if you live somewhere where there's contour, use that to your advantage. And that's a great way to stay in shape if you're not a runner.
Well, that's neat that transferred pretty well. So was Cam and Truett, were they running that race as well?
Truett didn't run it. Cam was there. Taylor Spike, his brother, was there. And I asked Cam, I was like, is anyone good going to run? And he was like, I don't know, my brother is running. And there ended up being one other runner that was decent. And I didn't want to let, so if I won the race, I didn't want to be second to the top. And so that was the biggest goal, was like, whoever was going to lead the race, I was going to keep them in sight until we hit the top. It meant more to me to be at the top, like first place at the top of the mountain, versus like just running fast downhill.
Okay.
So yeah, there was one guy that was really good going uphill, and I basically just hung on right behind him. And then we get to the top, and like right before it, I was strategy wise, it's like, you gotta, you got to go hard. Like to, when you, if you pass, you have to like, you know, leave them behind you. So it's just one of those running things. I grew up doing it. And so.
That's fun. I'm currently, so I'm basically just a novice runner and have been for about, I mean, for a long time now. One of the runs I do every year is a relay race. We run from, it's called the River to River. So it's the Ohio River to the Mississippi River, or the Mississippi River to the Ohio River in the southern part of Illinois. It's about 80 miles, and you have, I think, six or seven people that are in the relay. So you end up running like 10, 12 miles or something like that. So it's just three legs of 3.5 to 4 miles. It's not too bad. But we do have a little bit of elevation change. And so I'm currently just running for that. And I've only been able to run about one day a week, and I'll be ready for it. Looking forward to it, but that's kind of the extent anymore of what I do. So a quick question, sidebar here, but I did see that Truett just got that world record.
Yeah, world
pull-ups.
Wow.
And he said one of the next goals was, you know, his I guess the family PR for that marathon. So you and Truett run a marathon. Who's going to win?
Right now, probably Truett, because I haven't been training. And man, that guy is on next level status for health and fitness. And he's able to commit to it, right? Like if you have a full-time job available of just working out, then you're going to be Truett status potentially. I mean, and also he's gifted. Like the guy's got a lot of talent. I went to his, so Cam used back in the day would ask if I would go to his cross country meets and cheer Truett on. Cause I was actually, at that time I was like a really good runner, well-known, and Truett was just starting to get into, I think he was a freshman in high school at that time. And so I went and cheered him on at districts and things like that. Yeah, he's had a lot of talent in running over the years. I've been able to watch him, but then he got really bulky. But now I think his pull-up record's attributed to his running. I think because he dropped in weight and increased his cardio. I think the limiting factor for him in the pull-ups was the cardio. He was really strong, but that 24-hour mark is a long time to be doing pull-ups. And
yeah, right.
So I think that's what I've heard Cam saying is was like 20 pounds lighter and much more fit.
Yeah, well, it all came together. It's pretty cool to see that happen.
Amazing.
Follow that along over the last couple of years. It's just checking out YouTube and seeing what he's been doing. It's pretty cool.
Amazing.
Okay, so let's switch gears a little bit. I got two deer this year. Just got one with bow, one with my gun, and all here within 45 minutes from my house. Always looked at Western hunters and just love consuming the content or just watching and seeing what you guys are doing, how different that kind of hunting style is. And lo and behold, looks like you got four really good, blacktail or mule deer. I forget exactly what it was at this point, but it was just following along on Instagram and looked like you just had a great year. So I'm really just excited to hear hunting stories. So talk us through the year.
Okay.
And I just want to hear briefly about each one that you got and what was amazing about it.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. So right now, a year ago, I was preparing for a talk at a sportsman show. And I had already hunted all the West Coast. I've hunted Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and California for blacktail. So I thought, how cool would it be to just kind of share my experience at the sportsman show? So I was doing that, and it kind of occurs to me, like, well, I've never killed anything in California, blacktail-wise. And Washington was just one time, and it was one buck, and I got it done. So I limited experience, but yeah, I'm talking about how to do it. So I was like, well, how neat would it be to do all of those states in a year? And I'm the planner type, you know, it's like,
okay,
if it's possible to do something in a year or make it all happen, it's like, how do I make that happen? Fitting it together, playing with the puzzle pieces. So I did that and it all came together. My wife was gracious to like, let me do these hunts. And some of them came together way ahead of schedule. And I put in a lot of time with family and wife, leading up to it, knowing that there was the chance I'd be out a lot. And it just happened to turn out where some of the hunts were one day, 2 day kind of hunts. And I was fortunate to get it done. So starting with Alaska, there's a buddy we'd been planning for 3 to 4 years about going. We finally connected and said, let's do it. So we booked with a float plane pilot. We picked a random lake. We didn't really have much intel. We just knew that generally that island has high numbers. And we're like, we want to go to high numbers. We don't care about genetics because you can go to good genetic islands. You can go to islands with less or more predators. There's all these different like facts you could Google and search. But we're like, we want population. We talked to biologists. They're like, yep, good numbers. It's been good on the winters. So we got dropped. We get up to High Point and we see like $35 or yeah, $35, I believe.
Oh my gosh.
In the first evening. And we end up both tagging out with $2. That was the max you could get as a non-resident. And it was a beautiful place. And I think the thing that I've kind of realized now too is it's not just so much going up there to shoot a Sitka blacktail. Like say if you're like, oh, it's on the bucket list. I want to get a Sitka blacktail deer. It's way more about having the experience to go to a place like that. It's okay. Public land. And it's incredible, like beautiful environment that you will not get anywhere else. So it almost should be sold as an adventurer, you know, experience. Like mm-hmm. that you get to nearly own an giant parcel of public land for your time there. And
that's awesome.
Yeah, it is so beautiful. So yeah, you mentioned film, and I did put out a film of that experience, and it's on my YouTube channel. I titled it Adam Crick. So that's my buddy who went. Adam is a stud, and we were a good pair. That's another factor, is like you want to have a good hunting partner on a trip like that. And there's brown bear. One instance is like his bow is off. We didn't know that, but he shot a buck with a gun. Mine worth archery, and he was going to try archery, but he packed a rifle just in case. So he shot a buck with a rifle. Buck goes down, or we assume it would go down, and we hiked back to get our packs. It had only been about 15 minutes. We looked behind us, and where he shot from, there was like a 8.5-foot brown bear with a sow with a cub.
Oh my.
And they come running up and they stop and she's kind of smelling the ground. And I was we're reflecting, like we were there like 10, 15 minutes ago. Had we thought like, let's just sit down and wait for 30 minutes, right, then go recover the buck. Had we, you know, packs were on at that, if we had packs, we would, brown bear running right up to us.
Holy smokes.
What do you do? And I packed a 10, but it was on my pack. And we dropped our packs up the hill, and that was pretty wild. Just things worked out in our favor on that trip in a lot of ways. And but those are some of the risks you take when you go to a place like that. But how neat was it to see a brown bear? And we weren't super afraid. Adam has lived in Southeast, spent a lot of time in the woods up there. So it's okay. Like, as long as you're calculated and you're not like approaching the bear, and they're generally afraid, they smell you, they run. Just the ones that are really hungry might not run. So I don't know.
But oh, that's great. That video was great. And I will put a link in the show notes to that for people to be able to check that out. And I mean, I'm assuming, and I've heard this from other just buddies that have hunted out there. You already mentioned it. You got to get somebody that if you're going out to hunt with somebody, it can't be somebody it's got to be somebody that's on par with you. So if you're looking around with your buddies and want to book a trip, you definitely don't want to go with somebody that's not going to be able to keep up, or you're not going to be able to keep up with them.
Yeah. And Adam was a basketball player, and he just, you know, he hits the gym pretty regularly, but we had never gone on a hunt together. So there was a level of risk even doing that. I do a lot of hunts by myself, and so it's hard to gauge like how I line up with another guy, you know, in terms of being on par with each other. But it was, but Adam, you know, it's just from conversations and trips we've done and passion for hunting. It's like, I think we're going to have a good time. And it turns out, he did amazing. So
awesome.
It was a good time.
Very cool. Okay. So two for two, I guess, on that trip.
Yep.
So then what's next? So where are you going after that?
Yeah. So those were archery harvests up there. I got 2 3-point bucks. They're largely 3 points for Sitka blacktail. So after that, that was early August. The season's up there open. I think it's August 1st. And it goes through December 31st. So big window for Sitka. So if you want to think strategy, that's the earliest you can hunt a black-tailed deer outside of California. California has a July season, end of July. So I started with Alaska based on early season, early hunt, doesn't conflict with other states. Next up on the list was California, which opens as early as last week in July. Many people probably don't know that. And it's the only, to my knowledge, it's the only public land over-the-counter black-tailed deer tag that you can do in July.
Oh,
pretty wild.
Okay.
Yep. And there's multiple zones that you could do that. There's the A and the B. So I went down to California, not in July because I was going up to Alaska, but when it opened for the archery, there's zone tags. So I bought a zone tag and it's good for archery season and rifle season.
Okay.
So the archery season is like mid August through early September. Rifle season is mid September through late October. So those are kind of the general timeframes, but all of that does not conflict with the other two states, Oregon, Washington, that are left on the list. So I went down with my bow, hunted the opener and the opening weekend on Sunday, ended up shooting a really cool 4x3. It's tall velvet buck. And the story is it was storming, foggy, horrible weather. Had to run to my tent. Yeah, on the opening day, pretty gnarly weather.
Awesome.
And you're up high, you know, like really, really high elevation, exposed. It's just gnarly country. Like, I'll eventually have a film. I'm working on it now to kind of depict what that looks like. And it's rugged. So it was the second day, weather broke, open, the skies opened up, it was sunny. And that's when I spot the bucks I had seen on opening morning, right before all the weather hit. And then it was an all day stalk to get into range. The bucks got up from their beds and fed away. I thought it was over. So I'm like, going to just go back to the tent and try again, which would be Monday. And as I'm hiking out, I look down and see the bucks bedded. I was like, well, shoot, I have like 45 minutes left of daylight. I'm here. It's three-ish miles back to my tent and I'm way in here. It's like, let's make the most opportunity. So I just jam down and I crawl into 30 yards and that's where I shoot that buck.
Awesome.
And almost pulled a double, missed his running mate, which was a 4-point. They ran out and I had two tags. So you can have two zone tags in California.
Wow.
I don't think I mentioned that. Just like Alaska, two tags. So missed the other buck. Would have killed me to get two bucks out of there. Next day, packed it out. Took me, you know, till midnight to get to my tent and then hiked out to my truck, came back, empty camp and buck and got out of there. So that was California. And then work was super busy. Like there's no time. And then family obligations. And so the rest of archery season, I went one more time for 2 days and came home. And then rifle season comes around and I went down one time on the opener to hunt rifle with a buddy. Didn't do any good. So this would be trip number four, which were all 2-day trips. So trip number four, went down for the very last, it would be 2 days this season. Went down on a Friday morning. So I guess I would have had 2.5 days to hunt. And it was opening. It was the first day down there. So of third to the last day of season, I do this mega hike. I drop my tent on the spine of a ridge and gritting through all this big timber. I'd been there before the year before and I had bucks were showing up at the last week in this rifle season. So I had some confidence that I might see something and a buck that I was particularly after. It was on trail camera, big 3x4. And I'm hiking back to my tent. It's almost dark and I'm jamming up the ridge, just trying to get back to my tent. And there is a little bit of glassing I could do from the ridge I'm camped on, but basically the day was over. Looking at my feet, I randomly look up right about to the point of my tent and there's this buck standing looking over like a cliff edge basically at me 10 yards away. So,
oh my gosh.
Yeah. And it's rifle season and I could pack a bow, but for the sake of, you know, limiting the time away from home, packing the rifle, click off safety, come up, kaboom, buck runs. And I get up to my tent. It was like 10 yards away from the buck. Drop my pack. I'm going through it to get out my headlamp. Batteries are dead. So I use my iPhone and I'm out looking for blood with my iPhone and right where the buck was standing. And it's like, well, I know I hit him. And that's the difference too with archery and rifle. The boom, the commotion, it's hard to know what happened. And like an arrow, you see it, you hear it, you see where it hit, all of those things. Rifle. So I'm in the dark. So I'm using my phone. And I'm looking for blood, seeing a little bit, trail the tracks. Then it goes over a cliff on the nose of that ridge that I'm camped on, using my phone to look for the buck. I'm thinking, gosh, do I come back tomorrow? No. My tent's right there. Just keep using the phone. So I end up finding that buck with my iPhone headlamp.
Nice. Yeah. Nice.
And it only made it like 80 yards, I think.
Okay. Gotcha.
Pretty wild. So that's California.
Okay. So California, and then so you had, I guess, to run back, work, family, all that again, and then you got to go down, was it Arizona? Was that last?
Well, Washington and Oregon,
Washington.
yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
I'll make those more brief. So I got that buck, came home on a Saturday night, and was able to just hammer out a bunch of things at home. And it was the middle of the week, would be the last days of Washington season for the modern rifle. So it was like a Wednesday morning, and I think season ended on Thursday. And I told my wife, like, hey, would you be all right with me? Work lined up where I could take 2 days off right then. And would you be all right with me running up to Washington and hunting for the last 2 days of season? She's like, sure, go for it. So I did. So I got up
Nice.
at 3 a.m., drove up there. You could buy a tag from a point of sale. And I was out hunting by like 8:30. The only thing I saw was a dead buck that first day out. Second day, the second animal, this one was living, was a really wide 3x4. And
Okay.
so it's a rifle hunt. So again, packing the rifle and the buck, like just in the big timber, I'm way out in the middle of nowhere, mega timber, steep country, gnarly, like cliffs everywhere. And then I just kind of know that's my bread and butter, is like I know how to hunt that terrain.
Okay, gotcha.
And Washington's very low numbers relative to Oregon, but an incredible country, and there's deer there. And the deer are usually, like, if you could find one, it's an older buck. Like
Okay.
that's the gamble, is like low density, but usually mature animals. So buck was 25 yards away. Pull up, boom, shoot it. And I'm not a rifle guy, so it's like it's kind of funny to tell stories about rifle hunting. So buck goes down, long pack out, brutal. And now I've just done nothing but pack out, pack out, pack out. And then I had a good break there from that until the weekend before Thanksgiving is when Oregon opens. And the fourth day of Oregon season, I ended up getting my buck. And it's like I don't want to make my story too long, but yeah, that buck, I was gonna hold on to my tag, and I didn't really want to tag out. I wanted just to hunt the full season. And that buck shows up, and I first started to film him, then realized it was really big. And by the time I got my cameras down and arrow loaded, the buck was 45 yards. And I get him to stop, draw back, and actually miss. So yeah, I miss him with my bow. So I drew back, my hands are numb, and my release had been it's an old release, and it had gotten pitch on it and had been wet and different things, but my hands were kind of numb, and so it was kind of gumming up, and it's a heavily back tension release. So I'm pulling on it, and I was expecting it to go off. It didn't, and I flinch. And it's just one of those things of like mind expectation and muscle memory says this is when the arrow goes off, and it didn't. So I flinch, expecting the arrow to go off, and that's, a problem that people can have in archery. Shoot over its back, buck runs. I pursue, come over the ridge line, dropping down, and he didn't know what happened. And he ends up hitting a trail and coming up above me. And it was like an 18 yard shot, and I shot him perfect on that one.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So there we go. That makes it through the blacktail saga.
Nice. So, as far as the history of hunting for you, then where's this season rank? Is it up in the top season for you, or is this kind of like a above average or average season? Where's it rank?
Yeah, I call it big years, and I see folks have like really big years at times. They get a good buck, a good bull, and maybe a good bear all in their state in the calendar year. And you're like, wow, that was amazing. Like, how did the stars align for that season? Whereas other years, you may not get even one animal that compares with that class and that experience and things like that. But this is, yeah, number one.
Awesome.
Every state had a mature animal. Like either really, really old or a really good buck. Like the blacktail in Oregon is my second best buck of all time.
Okay, gotcha.
And yeah, so just wild.
A season to remember for sure. We've got a young group of guys at the church. I mean, kids, my son and their buddies, and they're all getting into hunting. And my son at this point, he's 10, so he wants to have killed a good buck, but he doesn't want to yet put the time into, Mark Twain said a classic is a book that everybody wants to have read, but nobody wants to read. And it's like with hunting, this is how Ransom is at this point. He's like, I want to have killed a deer. And the reason is because all his buddies started to get a deer this year. And one of the boys, we're actually going to have him on the podcast with my sons. He killed two really nice deer this year, like one big mature 5.5 year old whitetail.
Wow.
And then another one, he got another one in gun season, another, so two of the gun, and it scored a 176 and an eighth. And
Whoa.
I'm talking a massive, big, mature deer, and he's 11. So
Yeah.
he had his best year that he'll probably ever have in Southern Illinois white deer as 11-year-old. And everything from that point on, you know, is going to be looking back to the year of 2024.
Yeah.
But a lot of hunting ahead of him for sure. But okay, so for a guy like me that's sitting in a stand, you know, I'm out of my house in the stand in 15 minutes and sitting there waiting for deer and thinking about, you know, how to even get into one day. So one day I want to take my sons out west, and as they get older, want to get into that. You mentioned you did kind of a lecture, a talk on, you know, how to, I guess, public land hunt and when it comes to blacktail. But what is a good resource or way for guys? I guess there's articles everywhere. People could Google, obviously. But what's your advice to somebody like me that says, hey, in 10 years, I'm going to bring my son out there and somewhere out there and either go for elk, blacktail, mule deer, something like that? What would be some good resources for us to check out?
Gosh, yeah, there's a lot of information out there. So I think if a person wanted to figure that out, I would say, like, if I didn't know anything about another state, I probably first would start following the different individuals that are successful in that state. That could be through listening to the podcast that they're on, finding them on YouTube if they have one, or finding them on social media. And when you look to those different individuals that are consistent, you kind of pick up on what they're doing. So that could be just exactly what they say, what it looks like they're doing. And then occasionally some of these people are open to sharing information and you could reach out. I was one of those types of people that is always open to help to some extent. But I feel like if you want to be a successful hunter out west, you have to put in the time. You have to hike. And it takes more than just knowing where to go or how to do it. There's all these different components. Like, you have to be very skilled with your craft, your bow or your rifle or whatever. You have to be very skilled with that regardless of where you're at. So if you're a tree stand hunter and you're in the Midwest or back east, you have to be very good with that bow. Whitetail are super jumpy. All those same traits apply. And you're going to be good whether or not you're in a tree stand or you're still hunting in the big timber in Oregon. So that skill has to be transferable. If you're sitting in a tree stand, you're not really using your legs and lungs and thinking critically, you know, during that hunt. So you're going to have to pick up that skill in another way. You could do that in a variety of ways. Basketball, I mentioned my buddy was a basketball player that went to Southeast with me. And I think basketball players produce good hunters because you're thinking on the fly and you're working as a team. And so you're juggling these different variables and yet you're competing and trying to win, and it's athletic. So it's hard, like lungs. And so I think that a lot of times when we do a competitive activity that's physical, that translates really well to Western hunting, because you're going to have a situation where animals running up, you're breathing hard, you're hyperventilating, your heart's pounding, and you got to think critically and make a decision in a split second on when to shoot, how to shoot, did you hold on it right? So, you know, and you get that work, you get worked up when a deer comes by your stand too, but you're on your feet, you know, is the difference. And you're trying to get balanced and on the side slope, bubble in with your bow. You feel that in the tree stand too, bubbling in, pinning in, and you're cold. So just lots of variables. So it takes all of those things you have to have mastered really well before you take on something that's hard, that's new. So that's hunting. If hunting out west is new for you, you got to have all those skills mastered before you try it. Then you'll have a good hunt. It'll be successful. Give yourself time. Just enjoy the experience. Don't set the bar so high that you're disappointed. It should never be a disappointing thing. You should be happy coming out just that you had the time, the experience.
Right.
Yeah. Because as a young kid, I just wanted to kill stuff. Like, that was, you know, same as like your son. He sees his buddy killing big animals. He's like, dang it. Like, I just really want that, but I don't even know how, where to start.
Right.
You just dream of pie in the sky. But I think with just earning the experience and working hard for it, it'll happen when it's meant to be. When it's meant to happen. Don't stress out about it. Shouldn't it be stressful?
Okay. Well, let's switch gears again. We'll wrap things up here in a minute. But you know, the wilderness, getting outside and getting in beautiful places.
Yeah.
There's so many people from, you know, Indians that lived here before us to people around the world that don't know, you know, the truth about God, but they do know that there's something to nature. And paganism, in fact, I mean, honestly, paganism in some ways kind of made a comeback a little bit, but you know, Christians, we don't worship creation, we worship creator. We see that God has created, you know, intricately the way the world works, and beautiful places, even after the fall, God blessing us with places that you got to hunt this year, you know, blessing us with places that we get to experience and see and look at and say, God, thank you. What is it about the wilderness, though, that, and I'm just asking from your experience, I'm assuming you're out there and it's also time with the Lord, you know, time to think or time to pray or just time to reflect on life. What is it for you, if that is impactful in that way, that there's a connection, not necessarily inherently because of the wilderness, but just because you know the God who made it, that is impactful for you? And I'm assuming that's one of the reasons that you like being out in the woods, out in the wilderness. So how does that work with you, and why do you enjoy that if you do?
Yeah, great question. When people, a lot of times if I hunt with somebody that doesn't necessarily have like strong faith, but they believe there's God and different things, it's like, it seems like the tendency is to almost worship like the actual created things, like the mountain is just so amazing and it's powerful or whatever, or the elements, or the animals, the light that you see, and its beauty, and nature is beautiful and creation is beautiful, is made to be good. Mm-hmm. And so God put these things here for us to enjoy and to live within, right? Like, we are here to use and be a part of creation. And again, it was intended to be good, but yet it's not meant to be like worship or idolized over our relationship with God. Mm-hmm. So like, when I'm in these really extreme remote places, I feel in awe of the place, but I feel in awe of the creator of those things. I feel mm-hmm. in awe that I'm able to have this life. What a gift. And then I get to be challenged here in this place and depend on my faith in God, that God will keep me safe and I can depend on him in these extreme environments. So I feel, in a way, kind of like weak. So it's like you have to depend on something outside of yourself, I believe, to have a strong faith. There has to be the recognition of the separation, the fall. You have to have some sense of, I'm not everything. I am not magnificent. Like, God is magnificent. He created me to be good, and he created me to depend on him. And so those are the things that I recognize when I'm in these extreme wilderness places that are also beautiful. Yeah. So I could be in all of that too, but also it points me to God. So that's kind of how I feel about it. And so if I do get the opportunity to take friends, and if there's any witnessing possibility, it's just like, you know, these things were created and they're awesome, mm-hmm. but God is awesome. So
yeah, that's so good. Yeah. That's so good. And I think for guys that have not been, you know, brought up in hunting, haven't been in the outdoors, wouldn't consider themselves outdoorsmen, or the kind of guy that wouldn't just naturally go on a hike or something like that, and they're hearing this, listening in, and it's my normal audience, and they're like, hey, where's the stuff on pastoral ministry or life or ministry or raising sons or whatever? And they're listening in. There are so many things in life that we don't know we enjoy until we actually try it. There's some things we try and we go and try some new thing or new hobby, and we actually, you know, don't enjoy it. It's like, I can respect that particular thing. But there was something that happened in me where it just clicked. I was 35, never hunted before in my life. And then I had a guy at church that said, hey, why don't you come out? And I'll just show you the ropes a little bit. And I grew up, I shot, I was in the woods. I went fishing, all that kind of stuff when I was growing up, but just didn't hunt. And then for the last 5-6 years now, this has been something that's been so incredible in spending time with the Lord and just the whole process of preparation. And then now including my sons in it, it's something really just wonderful. And so if you're listening in and you're like, yeah, that's cool. And, you know, Nate does this, and Jared occasionally, you know, gets out there during deer season. But that's not for me. Well, maybe it is though. Maybe it is for you. And this is a great way for you to do something that is multi-generational, to raise your kids and then think about, Lord willing, grandkids one day, and have a blast doing it and really just connect with the Lord through what he's made. And so a subtle nudge and encouragement to you, you know, give it a shot, ask questions, find somebody in your church that could maybe help you and show you the ropes like I had. And I know that, Nate, this is a family legacy for you. But yeah, well, hey, listen, I wanted to have you on just because I enjoy, you know, following your content, and I wanted to hear your stories. I knew that you'd been on some other shows, and so I wanted to bring you back on. One other comment. I'm taking the taking my sons through, I mentioned at the beginning, but a book called Boyhood and Beyond, and it's written by Bob Schultz. And Bob Schultz is from Springfield, Oregon.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So when I had your dad on, I asked if he knew him because Bob died in 2008, I think. But he was a master craftsman. He was a interior finish craftsman, and he did do some just whole house builds and stuff like that. But he started, he had four daughters and started writing to boys, young boys. He was commissioned to write books. He wrote four books for young boys that are growing up into manhood and maturity. And it's dynamite. So if you're looking for some little good books, a guy right from Springfield, Oregon, Bob Schultz, Boyhood and Beyond, he created a book called, or he made a book called Created for Work, Everyday Battles, and I can't remember the other one, but afterwards I'll send you some links or something like that to check that out. So, all right, where can people find more about your stuff? Where's a good starting point? So if getting into the films that you've created, where would you point people first? And then I'll put those links in. Where can people go to find out more?
Yeah, so at least from my content, it's Nathan Endicott Films is on YouTube. You can find it by those keywords is my channel. I've covered quite a few states. So if you just wanted like a quick view at different states and out west that I've hunted, like you could see what those hunts are like. So that's one way to follow along. I have an Instagram, Nathan For You. So that's one way to kind of follow along what I'm doing. I try to keep my Instagram just like forward thinking. So it's always what I'm doing. It's not what I did. What else? There's a bunch of podcasts out there that I've talked more in depth on strategies or tactics. I even have a Blacktail Tactics film. Those are all very specific to one type of hunting, but that's another resource. It'd be nice. I have a website and the goal is to get the different podcasts I've done on the website. So if someone was really interested in knowing more about telling a story and photography, it's like you could click that link. So eventually that's maybe next step.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, I appreciate the time.
Yeah.
And for those that are listening, again, we've been talking to Nate Endicott. Nate, appreciate it, man.
Yeah. Thanks, Jared.
Thanks again for listening to the Shepherd's Crook podcast. For more information, you can go to theshepherdscrook.co. Please consider leaving a rating or review on iTunes. And if you want to become a member of the Shepherd's Crook, please message me and we'll get you on the list. We hope you have a great rest of your day.